Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Big week at the movies this week. The Running Man is out. Edgar Wright's new film, We Have Seen It, starring Glenn Powell. We're going to talk about it here in a minute. We're also going to take a look at Keeper, the new Osgood Perkins trip. Some people are saying this is a miss, so I'm excited to talk about it. We're not going to talk spoilers or anything, but I'm looking forward to letting you guys in on what Keeper's got going on. We're going to take a look at some trailers. Crazy week for trailers, man. The holidays are coming up. All the studios are getting their trailers out early. October performed really poorly. Everybody's dumping trailers online, so we got some good stuff to talk about there. New Wake Up Dead Man trailer, Wuthering Heights trailer. We're going to talk about the Moana live action trailer Disney put out, so stick around for that. And before we get to everything, we talk about the news. First story this week, Andy, you're not going to believe it. Tom Cruise is an Academy Award honoree. He was honored with an Academy Award over the weekend at the Governor's Awards. This is not a part of the official broadcast of the Oscars. They didn't actually do the Oscars, and you missed it. This is just kind of, you know, something they do on the side, and they didn't televise it. They gave Tom Cruise an award, and he had this really cool, kind of cool speech. And I just want to talk about it for a second. We got some footage of it online, and we're looking at an article from Hollywood Reporter about it. What do you know about Tom Cruise getting an Academy Award?
So Tom Cruise and the Oscars have always kind of had a bit of a friction-filled relationship. He has been nominated 3 times for acting, once for producing, never won. And he kind of gave up the pursuit of Oscars in the mid-90s, decided to just focus on basically being a movie star, Mr. Movies. And he doesn't go to the Oscars, and so it's a little bit of a strange relationship. But he's such a huge institution. He's been in the film business for 45 years, an absolute monolith of a cultural icon. And so they finally decided to give him an honorary Oscar. It's really incredible stuff. He was nominated in 1989 for Born on the 4th of July, which is an incredible movie and performance about a Vietnam vet before, during, and after the war. He lost to a little known actor known as Daniel Day-Lewis for My Left Foot. But what are you going to do? Absolutely one of the best actors of all time. So it's been a strange relationship, but it's nice to see him. And a lot of people think that, like, a lot of times when you get one of these honorary Oscars, you end up winning one for real a year or two later. So we'll see if that happens.
Yeah, look, it's weird that he doesn't have one, right? Like, my man's kind of got GOAT status here. He's been in so many great films. He's contributed a lot. And that's a lot of what his speech was about. It was actually really cool. He did this one moment where he asked anybody in the room who'd ever worked with him to just stand up. And you're not only getting really cool people like Spielberg and Alejandro Iñárritu, Christopher McQuarrie, but you're getting tons of actors and actresses. Like 2/3 of the room stands up. Like, it's a great moment, like, for everybody to come together and be like, hey, man, so many people have worked with this guy over the years. He's been a part of so many great projects. And he really champions that. Like, he talks in the speech about how much he loves movies and how he wants to be a part of it and want to help new talent in. Like, it is just, like, kind of his whole being, right? When he's not, that's kind of it. That's kind of all of his public appearances is that's what Tom Cruise has going on. So it was neat. It is a little weird he hasn't won one, like, legitimately. I hope he does, you know? It seems like a layup. I feel like the next time he gets nominated for one, it's almost a shoe-in that he's going to get it, because it's just like, it'd be such a great moment. It's weird that they didn't broadcast this on television. Like, I've seen clips floating around online, but, like, man, y'all probably should have done this during, like, the actual awards. He could have gotten up and given a big speech, would have made for a bunch of clips. But even still, they honored a few other artists, notably Dolly Parton, Wynn Thomas, and Debbie Allen here. You know, kind of cool, but I think Cruise is kind of the moment. And for a bit of a slow week at the box, a slow week in movie news, I think it was worth at least talking about. Can we talk about this Labubu movie going on at Sony?
Real quick, I just want to mention that Tom Cruise is working on some super secret kind of action movie with Alejandro Iñárritu, who actually presented him with the award. And there were some stills of them working together that just came out this week. We don't know what this is, but maybe, you know, that could be the movie that wins him an acting Oscar. It would be kind of incredible to see. So that's early on in development. We'll see what that's about.
I tell you what was really wild about this thing. When they played the montage of, like, Cruise performances, like, up to him, like, going on stage, like, not only was it a ton of footage from a ton of different films, it was all in, like, sequential order, which is just, like, It's like a great flex, right? Just banger after banger after banger after banger. Like, just awesome. Most actors and actresses, it's going to be a montage. It's kind of, you know, spread out, a smattering of their filmography. But, like, you don't got to with Cruise. It's just one after another. So, yeah, man. Glad he's got one. Shoot, I hope they put it on, slates going forward and trailers in. Academy Award winner. Might as well. Throw it in. Why not? I know it's an honoree, whatever. But, like, come on. Come on. It's Cruise. We got to talk about this Boo Boo movie at Sony. Big Emoji Movie vibes from the studio that made Emoji Movie, of course, Sony. We have an announcement. They are making a Labubu film based on the Labubu doll plush line that you might have heard about on the internet. What do you know about this, Andy?
So very early development. We don't know anything about any kind of plot or anything like that. Labubus are a little bit older than you might think. They were actually started in 2015. They were bought or produced by Pop Mart starting in 2019, but have exploded, I think, within about the last year. That's when we've seen them become more mainstream. I got duped into buying a fake one for a friend. Shady gas station, but they're everywhere. And it's what's interesting to me is that it's not really surprising for Sony or any studio to jump on a trend of the moment. What's interesting to me is the similar items that have not been picked up, and the big elephant in the room is Funko Pops, because those things have been around for like 15 years, and they've never kind of gotten off the ground like a Lego movie or any kind of like animated thing. Or it seems like that would be the thing that's a little bit more familiar. They just haven't really taken off in the way that Labubus have, and so we'll be seeing that probably in the next couple of years. At that point, like, the trend may be over, the fad may just have come and gone. So it'll be funny if that's the case too.
It's particularly funny because Funko Pop is like actively failing and flailing, and they don't know what they're going to do. They just put out a statement like last week that was saying like they don't know how they're going to make it through the next fiscal year at this rate. Like they are going down with the ship, and they've tried to do stuff in the past. I know they put out a video game where they had a bunch of Funko Pop stuff you could do, and you had a bunch of licensed characters, right? Everybody's in that. Back to the Future and Ghostbusters and Stranger Things, God knows what else, right? Like, Funko Pop's licensing deals reach far and wide. That makes making a movie complicated, naturally. You got to pay out a lot of companies, you're going to make a Funko Pop movie. But Labubus don't particularly apply to any of those, right? We don't have a lot of licensing deals to worry about. You just got a couple small Chinese companies and manufacturer, and I think the distributor Pop Mart might have a part of this, but otherwise, don't know if it's animated or not. Almost assuredly animated, right? And it's a lot like, it reminds me of like meme stocks, right? Or meme coins. Like, this is Sony trying to cash in on a meme movie, just like they did with the Emoji Movie. Like, well, maybe if we make it fast enough, people will share memes about it and it'll do okay and make 30 or 40 million at the box office. I probably do well internationally, I would guess. I think that's where most Labubu content's consumed. Yeah, man. Just seems like a cash grab. It's a cash grab kind of movie. So, one thing, it's not a cash grab. Alita Battle Angel. You remember that movie? Because apparently James Cameron says he's still going to make it. Or he's going to make the follow-up with Robert Rodriguez. They have a blood oath to make Alita 2, and they are making progress. Big words from the guy who's got Avatar 3 coming out this holiday. What do you know about this, Andy?
So James Cameron is working on a couple of projects outside of the Avatar films. He also has a film called The Devils and Last Train from Hiroshima, which is supposed to be kind of the opposite end of Oppenheimer. It's showing like the Japanese perspective. Really brutal book, apparently. The book, I don't even think the book's out, or the book might have just came out. You could like pre-order, and it was already like, James Cameron is making this into a movie. It's not even out. But they're still interested in making Alita Battle Angel, a sequel to the 2019 follow-up. Interestingly enough, Alita Battle Angel was our very first YouTube review to that we made a video of. So that's where we start, way back in 2019. So I briefly looked into get the manga series, but it's like, it's $100 and it's five volumes plus a volume of short story. So it's long. It's like 2,500 pages of I think the movie covers maybe the first book or part of the first book. So there's a lot there to pull from. It'll be interesting what they do for part two, but they want to leave it open to where they can lead into a third movie either by them or someone else.
Yeah, the movie was just kind of fine. I think the script was maybe where it had the chunkiest problems, because as far as look and I remember action goes, it was really solid. And it's got just a bit of that Avatar DNA in it, right? Like hyper-realistic computer animation. The character of Alita kind of has these big expressive eyes that even, God, I remember when they dropped the first trailer for that, and then they went back and reanimated her eyes just a little bit to be bigger and more expressive, like just to kind of help separate that uncanny valley where she doesn't quite look human, but she is kind of like this android character. Either way, lots of fun. I don't know if Cameron ever makes this thing. Interestingly, he says that he just bought a house in Austin, and he's like 3 miles down the road from Robert Rodriguez. So he's like, well, now that we're going to be neighbors, I think we're going to be talking about it a lot more. But like, dude, he still wants to make Avatar 4 and 5. Allegedly, if he doesn't hand it off to some other director, like, I don't know. He's doing the submarine thing, right? He's Jim Cameron. He's going everywhere and doing everything. So I don't know if this ever gets made. But it'd be kind of cool. And the last one ended on a cliffhanger. Why not? Like, I think another pass at it might work. I think it did okay at the box office. Not huge returns, but, you know, sure. Make Alita 2. Why not? Follow up. Maybe make some sort of series, huh? Instead of a film. That might be neat. A few episodes on HBO or something. I don't know. We got to talk about Now You See Me clobbering everything else in the box office. Now You See Me, Now You Don't, the third film in the Now You See Me series of magic-oriented heist films is out. We didn't watch it for the podcast. Turns out everybody else did. It did great at the box office this week. What's going on with the numbers?
No one can predict what is happening at the box office at any one week. Sometimes it feels like you got the finger on the pulse, and sometimes you have no idea. Now You See Me 3, Now You Don't, debuted with $21.3 million domestically for a huge, but did really well overseas for $75.5 million globally. Really, like, exceeded expectations. I don't know how expensive this one, but it's like a mid-budget movie. I don't know much about this, but there's a little bit of lore, like some characters from the first two movies come back. This series first started in 2013, so it's not exactly like a fresh IP, but people are still into fake magic tricks, and apparently it's a very Hollywood movie where it's like you got like Rosamund Pike is playing like a Bond-esque villain, and they all use the power of magic and friendship to defeat whatever, and it's a real popcorn feature, and it's hitting, so that's done really well, surprisingly.
I remember being so disappointed with the ending of the first Now You See Me, because the whole gimmick is that the four horsemen are like these four, like, David Copperfield-esque magicians, right, that do stage shows and performances, and everybody loves them, and they have a big social media following. And then at the end of the first one, surprise, it's all real magic, that none of it's sleight of hand. They're real, like, magicians and have this supernatural ability to perform magic. So I didn't even bother with the second one because, I don't know, I was just like, oh, that's the reveal at the end? Surprise! It was all real, and by real we mean clumsy CGI. Pass for me. Like, just kind of not. Didn't do it. I guess I thought it'd be more like, I don't know, the Prestige, Christopher Nolan movie, like The Illusionist. Like, I thought there'd be a little bit more to it, but no, it's pretty one note. Turns out the second movie didn't do that good. I think it made something like $40 million. You know, it's fine, but not great. And now, a few years later, Now You See Me 3 comes out, does way better than the second one did. Apparently, it's real tongue-in-cheek. It seems to be self-aware. It knows what it is. It knows it's goofy. And yeah, you got a cast of like 7 people at the top. You got the Jurassic World 3 problem, right? You got 19 people in the main cast. You got so many people, you can't fit them on the damn poster in this movie. And everybody's got 4 scenes. But somehow, it worked out. And what I think is really interesting is just how well it did overseas, dude. It made $21 million here. It made $54 million everywhere else. Why are international audiences skipping superhero movies and turning out for like schlocky magician cinema? What are we missing? I think people just want something different, right? They want something new. They want something fresh. And even if it's kind of a reheat of the old idea, like, you know, goofy magic tricks are fun. Jesse Eisenberg and Dave Franco running around in tuxedos and doing sleight of hand is fun. Like, I think that's kind of all it takes, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that it's a little bit of it's doing a Marvel, an MCU thing where it's like bringing in a bunch of people from the first two movies the first movie that weren't in the second. And it's like, again, bringing together a big cast of like, oh, this guy you thought was dead is actually not. that sort of thing. Yeah, it's a big hit. Moving on to The Running Man, which was the other big release, underperformed at $17 million, $28 million worldwide. That's pretty disappointing for this movie. I think it's pretty expensive. The first kind of miss from Glenn Powell, who had a string of hits with Top Gun Maverick, Anybody But You, and Twister, is really kind of the guy of the moment. I don't think it's entirely his fault. I'm not sure who else could have shouldered this movie. Predator Badlands came in at third at $13 million, $136 million globally. That's continued to be a big hit. And we're going to see, that's probably going to have some legs as well going into the holiday weekend. Regretting You, the Colleen Hoover adaptation, came in $4 million, $82 million worldwide, continues to print money. Black Phone 2, same thing, $2.6 million and $127 million globally. And then real quick, Demon Slayer Infinity Castle debuted in China to $53 million in China. This has been out since like the summer. When it first debuted in Japan, and has cleared $730 million globally. So that's also been one of the top films of the year. And no one's hardly talking about it because it's Japanese manga.
Yeah, we're going to have to start going to see Japanese films, Japanese animation, I guess. Like, these movies do so well. This, Chainsaw Man, did super good. Like, oh my God, that built-in audience will absolutely turn out at the movies. It's so funny that, like, it just seems like so many, like, American viewers, at least, I can't speak for international audiences, but they'll only go see three or four films a year. You know, you'll go see your big hits, Avengers, Spider-Man, whatever, and that's kind of it. You'll go see something around the holidays, but otherwise, like, people are not going to theater for months at a time, save for something hyper interesting to them, like Taylor Swift or a particular anime movie, a concert film. People will turn out for those because those are more like event based. Like, you even get this with like Fathom events. Those are continuing to be successful. Nostalgia screenings are doing really well. They're putting plays in theaters now. They got the Daniel Radcliffe's got a play. He's gonna be, Merrily We Roll Along is supposed to be a big thing. And even like Wicked, right, is kind of like a predecessor for that. Like, it just seems like people want to turn out for adaptation. People want to turn out for something that they already believe in, like a bought-in audience. And Demon Slayer, like, having so much success, like, makes cinema, makes the movie theater, like, less of a, like, place to discover something new and more of a place to see an evolution of something you already know. Like, we're in a funny place with adaptation. I don't know why I'm musing on this other than to say, good God, Demon Slayer has made so much money, dude. And meanwhile, like, Running Man kind of comes out flat, right? Like, doesn't quite make it back the way it needs to. Did you mention Keeper? I got too caught up in Demon Slayer to get down to where they were at, but they kind of bombed a little bit, right?
Keeper also a bit of a miss, but also I don't think there were high expectations for that as well. Interesting thing that movie was made during the labor strikes, because The Monkey, his previous film, had to go on hold, and so they started production on this, got a writer outside that wasn't quite union, and hired some, you know, worked in Canada basically to get around those restrictions. And that's I think it's just a smaller film. It's a bit of a, it's almost, I thought it was a COVID film initially, but yeah, we're in this place where people, again, IP rules, like, a star can't sell a film, but you get the right IP that people recognize. They recognize, you know, it's like, it's the death of the movie star. And when I was listening to the Big Pick podcast, they were talking about, it is over. Like, the movie star is dead. We've been talking about, is it? They're like, no, it's over, dog. Like, everyone is missing. No one can do it anymore.
A little bit. Yeah, no, I feel that. All right, let's talk about Running Man. No better way to talk about a movie star maybe not bringing people to seats more than this big action film starring Glenn Powell. I'm going to be taking the summary on it, so let me just jump right into it. The movie is The Running Man. So, The Running Man is an adaptation of an 80s Stephen King novel. This is not an adaptation of the Arnold Schwarzenegger film, but more revisiting of that original work. Glenn Powell plays Ben Richards in the alternate kind of dystopian American future of some kind of 2025, where Ben is living in poverty with his wife and very young daughter who's very sick and needs meds. Ben has just lost his job after trying to speak out on behalf of some employees at this place that had been affected by radiation. He was talking to a union rep, got canned, desperate for work and looking for a way to make some quick money to help out his daughter. Ben agrees to be on try out for a game show at the network building that one runs Freevee television that anybody can watch, right? It's free, of course. And going to the network building and trying out for to be on a game show. Ultimately, it comes down to he is destined to be on The Running Man. This is a show where three contestants are try to survive 30 days in the United States while anybody can record them and report them to mercenaries or hunters who can assassinate them live on television. Right? We've got roaming cameras that follow you around in a studio led by Coleman Domingo, who is just doing it up so big, being the announcer for The Running Man. Ben initially doesn't want to do it, but ultimately kind of gets coerced into signing by this program director, Josh Brolin, who's playing this really funny Vince McMahon sort of character. And that's our movie. We've got 30 days to try to get away and survive. Every day that Ben makes it, he gets a little bit more money. Every goon, alternative name for kind of police officers, that is eliminated along the way, he gets additional money. It all goes straight to his family. He's got to wear this wristband, and he's got to mail in these videotapes every day to let them know that he's still alive and kicking, and hopefully give people clues to where he is. It's a lot of kind of conspiracy. There's a bit of class warfare in here. Obviously some action, all led by Glenn Powell, of course, and is directed by Edgar Wright, who we last saw with Last Night at Soho. Before that, Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and the Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End, which he's most likely well known for. I think people had hoped it'd be a return to form for Edgar Wright, right? Get back into action. He's got a big budget, $110 million, I think it was, to shoot this movie. He's got Glenn Powell being a movie star at the center of it. And of course, it's King adaptation, which have been wildly successful as of late. The last one we watched was The Long Walk, a bit more heady, a bit more slower, a lot walking and Running Man. But either way, I'm talking too much about it. Andy, what'd you think of The Running Man?
Man, so a lot of this works, and then a lot of it also doesn't. It's real up and down. I think some of the action sequences overall, when they happen, real strong. They take forever to happen. The first big one doesn't happen until almost an hour in. It's just, it takes a long time to get going. I think Glenn Powell is an interesting choice. I think he does what he can with the role. We'll talk a little bit more about some alternatives, but I think he's doing... I feel like this is almost his audition to be an action star, and I think he does well. I don't know what the box office will mean for his future, but there were a couple of scenes where he was running, and I was like, oh, he's doing the Tom Cruise running gag.
Yeah.
Like he is the next Ethan Hunt. Like he could be that guy. I don't know if they will, because the film's not doing well, but it's interesting to see him in this role. He's not quite angry enough for this, 'cause he's supposed to be the angriest man. But yeah, the movie's all over the place tonally, plot-wise. There's characters you meet briefly and never see again several times. It seems it's a mix of, like, it's trying to be funny but cheeky, but also serious about bringing up social justice issues, but doesn't take them too seriously. It's just, it's really all over the place. It needs to pick a lane and stay in it, and it doesn't.
Yeah, I was really surprised at the scope of The Running Man, because looking at the trailer, I haven't seen the Arnold Schwarzenegger film. I didn't read the book. But looking at the trailer, it seemed like it was all going to take place in, like, a city, right? Like, he was going to hide out with some friends and join the resistance or something and try to make it. But actually, it turns out it's a bit of a kind of a it's not quite a road movie, but it's a bit of a globetrotter. Like, we end up moving through large parts of America. We move from New York. I think we end up in maybe Chicago. We're in Maine at one point, like, kind of away from the city. Like, Ben Richards actually runs quite far, which was a nice surprise, especially considering the runtime. It's a little over 2 hours. Feels a little overstuffed, going to be honest. But I did like Wright's, like, dystopian future. Feels a little bit like Bong Joon-ho's Mickey 17, right? Everything's kind of grimy.
Yeah.
And everything's like mechanical doors that whip open and close, right? And everybody's very cynical, and it's very nihilistic. We have kind of this new currency, new dollars, that everything works in, that very charmingly have Arnold Schwarzenegger's face on them. It's a nice nod to him in that other movie. But I like the way this world feels. Like, it's dark and it's twisted and it's cynical, and there's violence on Freevee. But also, like, people are very tired of the conditions. And it's very obvious as the movie goes on that Ben Richards is coming out of poverty, and that the people who are kind of helping him are also in poverty. And they're like, hey, man, we're going to do something about the rich. And it kind of turns into a bit of a resistance movie. And I think that's part of where you run into these tonal problems, because at the beginning of the movie, Ben Richards is supposed to be the angriest man ever. There's a woman who literally says, you're the angriest person who's ever tried out for The Running Man. You're the angriest applicant. And, like, Glenn Powell can be a lot of things. He can be a lot of things. He's had success in Anyone But You, big rom-com, Twisters, where he brings back like kind of a nostalgia feature. Like, he can be a cowboy, he can be a security guard, he can be a stockbroker in The Dark Knight Rises. But I don't know if he's the angriest man ever. He just kind of isn't, right? Like, if you're looking for the angriest guy ever, you're probably looking for Jason Statham kind of character. You're looking for the beekeeper. And that's not really what this is. But meanwhile, Colman Domingo is like bursting off the screen, and every scene he's in his little studio, he's amazing and funny and like totally gets the assignment. Brolin is not in as many scenes. He's mostly kind of a faraway virtual antagonist. He's good. Lee Pace is in this movie. He is masked almost the whole film.
Almost the whole film.
Really wasted. Strange, like, to have Lee Pace and you're just... Yeah, like, it's like The Mandalorian. I'm like, is that even him in there? Or you just have some extra and you just had Pace out for, like, these views? It'd be a lot cheaper if that wasn't actually Lee Pace in there. It'd be way cheaper to shoot with an extra. But, like, Michael Cera is in this movie. It's kind of funny. Like, it seems like it's got a decent cast, but a lot of them just seem to be pushed to the background while Ben Richards is, like, I don't know. On the one hand, like, being a nice guy and learning about, like, you know, how we can come together and overcome all this. But on the other hand, he's like taking people hostage and like committing fairly violent crimes. And I think that's part of that tonal problem people are running into.
Yeah. They couldn't decide how they wanted to use him because, yeah, you want your protagonist to be, you know, charming and sad. And like, he's got this, his kid is sick, it's this tragic backstory. And then when Powell has to be intense, he gets there and it's really good, but then it's too much. He's like a nice guy. It reminds me of Jake Gyllenhaal in Roadhouse 2, where he's like a super nice guy who's going to beat everyone up. It was like, it doesn't quite mix. He's kind of got to be a little bit tougher. Like, again, Jason Statham is the perfect, he would be perfect for this movie. The problem is, in that case, then it's a Jason Statham movie and you get a Jason Statham movie, not an Edgar Wright movie. So that would probably be more successful though, honestly. So I think Powell is doing the best he can. He's just got to be meaner more of the time. Yeah, the rest of the cast is pretty incredible. Josh Brolin doing evil executive guy. Colman Domingo like tearing it up as the host. He's the highlight of this. But then, yeah, you have another cast of characters that you meet along the way, but then you just never see them again. We have William H. Macy, Michael Cera, a couple of other people we run into, and it's like, the story isn't very focused. When he starts The Running Man, there's a couple of other compatriots. What's her name? Katie O'Brien, who was also in Twisters.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the name of that
movie.
Some
guy Love from Lies SNL. Leading. Yeah.
And she's great. And I was like, it would have been cool to stick with her character for just a little bit. And it's just so Ben Richards focused that, it could have gone balanced a little bit more, but it really is all over the place tonally.
Yeah. I want to talk about the action a little bit. That was something I was really looking forward to, like getting out of Wright again. Last Night in Soho has a little, but like a lot of that is more like dance numbers with Anya Taylor-Joy and Matt Smith, who are both fantastic in that movie. Like, that's some of the stuff that works the best. But overall, Last Night in Soho is clunky. It's less than the sum of its parts. And I think Running Man kind of has a similar problem. There's a few sequences in here that are rock solid. You could watch them on TikTok in a year and be totally glued to your phone. There's a hotel escape in here that's nuts. The Michael Cera stuff that's been advertised and kind of like this Home Alone sequence where he's got all these like home-built traps, great. There's some car action in here that's real good. And like you said, Glenn Powell is running. Like, he's doing the Tom Cruise run. He is running in this movie.
Arms
like,
up.
Just yeah, like the Colman Domingo stuff in studio is a lot of fun. Like, there are sequences in here that work real good, but then when you put it all together, it like just feels bloated and overstuffed and tries to do too much, I think, socially. Like, it's kind of trying to have this social message in the middle of it. And while I agree with much of that messaging, you can't have it both ways, dude. You can't have Ben Richards be the angriest guy ever and also like hero to the poor. Like, those aren't quite the same thing. And it really tries to make it the same thing. It makes for a clunky ending. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to get into spoilers, but I do know it's different from the book. And I don't know if that's better. Like, actually hearing how the book ends, it's quite nihilistic, because I think a lot of 80s King projects were, right? Like, very...
Yeah, for sure.
Just run you down ragged, right? My man, King was in a different era then, and he was under the influence of a lot of substances, and he wrote a lot of wacky stuff. And this is wacky, but it tries to save it at the end. It tries to pull the plane up and be like, actually, this is good and wholesome and right, and it just makes for an odd ending that's, I think it's a half hour too long, and that's really a shame.
Yeah, pacing is a real problem. So this is 2 hours and 10 minutes, 15 minutes, something like that. And when I saw the runtime, I was like, oh no, oh no. Like this is solid 100 minute. This is a solid 100 minute idea. And it slows down a lot. And there's just a whole lot of talking sometimes. And I was like, what are we doing? Why is this scene in here? Why are we not like go, go, go like this? It needs to have that Mad Max feel like you're being chased on the run. He's just kind of hiding more. Yeah. Call it the hiding man. Like he's not on the run as much. I wanted to talk about the 1987 version. I used to watch that all the time on like TNT. It used to come on the 90s in cable. Yeah. So I'd always catch bits and pieces. The premise for that, it basically just takes the opening premise of like a game show with one person chasing another, but it's all kind of contained. You have a group of runners, and then you have like basically Terminator style other things trying to kill them. And it's more grown up. It's a little grisly. It's a weird classic, but it was a box office failure essentially. Didn't make its money back, but somehow still kind of a Schwarzenegger classic in that way. But yeah, that movie doesn't. It just takes the premise of the book. It doesn't take anything else, like plot, story, or anything.
Yeah,
like that.
I've always heard it's kind of just an excuse to make like a B movie Arnold with like a bunch of Arnold movie with a bunch of costumes. Yep. And like, you know, explosions and stuff. And that's fine. Yeah, it's rough, man. I think a lot of people had big expectations for this. Like, Wright has not put out anything quite like this in a minute. Like, he kind of has a reputation for putting out really solidly paced action and like really good beat for beat editing. Great needle drops, of which there are a few in this movie. Solid music, no surprise there. But it's not Baby Driver, and it's not Scott Pilgrim, and it's definitely not Hot Fuzz. And it's rough because it's like, dude, Hot Fuzz is so good. And like, you could just feel a little bit of it in there. Like, some of these actions, it was real solid. Like I said, there's a hotel escape scene in here that's a lot of fun. You can keep up with what's going on. And there's other bits where like a character makes a surprise decision in the third act that is like so bafflingly stupid. You can't even keep, like, why would you do that? That's the dumbest thing I've, but it's, I don't know. It's like it owes something to itself that I just, ends up messing it all up. I think you strip it down, you tighten it up. I think there's something here. I don't think it's bad. Let me be clear. Like, we talked about Tron Ares a few weeks ago. Tron Ares, I think, was bad. This is all right. And I think there's probably general audiences who will come out thinking, oh, Running Man was good, right? Like, there's definitely people out there who will, I think, like this. But it's kind of a miss, I think, from Wright, ultimately. And, like, that's a bummer because it's such a big budget. Like, I think he had a lot of opportunity here. I don't know. Yeah, I think Powell doesn't really work. I think Wright doesn't really work. Like, he's just kind of like close, but no cigar.
So I heard in an interview where Edgar Wright talked about this movie. He talks about most of the time you have to kind of will a movie into being, like, you have to really work at it. It's hard to get anything made. And he said this was the opposite, where like the studios, the suits were really on this. They're like, why aren't you making The Running Man? Why isn't it out? And he shot this. It only stopped shooting in April, and they've been, or the end of March, and they've been doing VFX for the last 6 months, and they just finished it like 2 weeks ago. But the studio really wanted this movie, and they wanted and they were fine with Glenn Powell, so they, you know, the powers that be made it happen. But I feel like Edgar Wright has really missed more than he's hit in the last like 15 years. Last Night in Soho is a big miss. There's some visual things that are interesting. Baby Driver is pretty solid, but then before that it's Scott Pilgrim. So his last two entries now just not real solid. And I feel like he is victim of the studio, of the tragic story of a talented young director being scooped up by a studio, and then now he's just doing studio projects, and we're not getting the freshness of Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead, those classic films from 20 years ago now.
Yeah. You know, I just rewatched Citizen Kane last week, and I was reflecting on how Orson Welles turned that out when he was like 25. And there's this great quote later in Orson Welles' life when he said something like, I got it here. I started my career with a masterpiece, and I've been slowly working my way towards the bottom ever since. And I don't think that's true with Wright. I think there's a good chance like Wright's best work is yet to come. But damn, Hot Fuzz just looks better every year. Like, Scott Pilgrim is great to revisit, and like Shaun of the Dead's a lot of fun. Like, I even like World's End a bit. Like, I don't know. I've revisited Soho and liked it less the second time around, and I'm worried that'll be the case with this. But like, ultimately, I think it's a mid-entry for him. Like, not bad, not great. I don't know if it'll make its money back. We should work down to recommendations here. Any other thoughts for recommendations, Andy?
No, I think I'm ready.
Would you recommend The Running Man?
I would say save it for streaming. It is a fun Edgar Wright film. It's a little bit too long. It's tonally all over the place. The pacing is off. But Glenn Powell's a lot of fun. I think he's doing the best he can with the material. I think he could be an action star. The rest of the performances are real strong. The action's pretty good. So if you're interested, I'd say save it for streaming.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. I really wish I could say go see it in a theater, but like, dude, it's long. It's gonna be a lot of your day watching Running Man, and like, I don't know. Yeah, I think wait till it comes home. I went and saw it in XD on a big screen at Cinemark, and it was fine. I guess if you're gonna go see it, probably go see it in a premium seat. Skip the D box. You don't got to do anything crazy. All right, but you know, go see it big if you can. It's not bad. It's not great. Better than Soho, though. I definitely like Running Man better than Soho. I want to be clear. Soho's a different tone. But this, I think, has more that works in it than Soho did. So, I don't know. We got to talk about some trailers, upcoming stuff. Like I said, big week. All the studios are getting their trailers up. We got four for you, hand-curated. Andy, what do we call this segment?
It's time for the Trailer Park.
First trailer on deck, the new Super Mario Galaxy movie. Yeah, the follow-up to Nintendo and Illumination's $1.2 billion smash hit, the Super Mario Brothers movie. We have a new trailer out for it. This is, you know, kind of more of the same. Seems to pick up right where the old one left off. King Bowser, the bad guy in the first one, big dinosaur played by Jack Black, is still shrunk down small. We got Mario and Luigi who are hanging out with them. And we realize King Bowser's young son, I guess, Bowser Jr., shows up to break him out of his small jail and hopefully, you know, make some special things happen. A lot of funny Mario stuff going on in here. I played a bunch of these games, and I remember when there was a rumor that it was going to be themed around Galaxy, I was like, that's stupid. Galaxy came out years ago and is kind of popular, but there's a lot more they could do. They could pull stuff from the new games. And it turns out like they've just blended a ton in here together. There's stuff from the newest Switch game, Super Mario Odyssey. Like there's a whole world in there with characters. There's stuff from imagery from Super Mario Sunshine over on GameCube. So just because it says Super Mario Galaxy, forget that. It just might as well be the Super Mario Brothers 2 movie, really. Like, they just kind of, I don't know. I don't know why they went with Galaxy. I guess because it scores high on SEO or something. But what do you think? Another Billy, huh? Another billion for Mario?
Yeah, this looks great. It really does. The first thing that came to mind was, man, the animation looks really solid, looks really good. Like Illumination just always knows what they're doing. This is mostly an announcement trailer. We get to see our familiar voices. We see Jack Black doing his thing with Bowser. What took me out of it though was as soon as Chris Pratt speaks, I'm like, oh, that's not like, that doesn't sound like Mario. That's just Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
Everyone else is fine. one of the big reveals is that Brie Larson will be doing the voice for Rosalina, which is another princess in the Super Mario universe. So and also Benny Safdie doing Bowser Jr. Yeah. As if the kids care that Benny Safdie, yeah.
Benny Safdie, what'd you get VO while he was out wearing a sandwich board telling people to go see the Smashing Machine? Like, what is this guy doing when he's not making movies? It's baffling. The Curse, the Smashing Machine, Bowser Jr. in the Super Mario Galaxy movie. It's crazy. I don't know. It's coming out April 2026. Like I said, it'll be a Billy for sure, man. All the kids will be talking about Super Mario Brothers 2 movie. And for what it's worth, first one's pretty fun. Probably a solid date night movie. So, you know, keep an eye on it. Keep an eye on us here for more. What's next? Oh, God. Yeah, I know what's next.
Wuthering Heights. So we got the full trailer for Emerald Fennell's new adaptation of Wuthering Heights, which comes out right on Valentine's Day. It's gonna be a big date movie, and we had some music releases. My excuse to talk about Charlie XCX, who released a track called House, and also Chains of Love, I think. And the Chains of Love is the music that goes over this. The trailer basically tells the entire story of Wuthering Heights, which I had to look up because I'm not super familiar with the literature, but It starts with our two main characters, Heathcliff and Catherine. They're in love, but he's poor. She's basically betrothed to a more wealthy person. He eventually comes back in their life. the whole story is kind of laid out in this trailer. It looks really good. I hate to say it. It does, because I'm not a fan of Emerald Fennell. And she's got this weird obsession with Gone with the Wind in comparisons here. There's like the poster looks like the Gone with the Wind poster. There's some shots, and it's like, that's kind of a problematic film to begin with. But this does look really good. I'm much more interested in this. I'm super excited that Charlie XCX is doing the soundtrack. So I'm up on Emerald Fennell. I'm going to give her one more chance. Like I said, I think she's a good director. She just needs to not be writing the script.
Yeah, I this trailer's great. It's a really great looking trailer, dude. And that's, I think, in part due to a couple of things. Number one, the incredible cinematography from Linus Sandgren. He's returning from Saltburn. It is so good looking. And there's so many shots in this trailer. Just cut, 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 cut. Like, they all look fantastic. Incredible lighting, like big shapes, big silhouettes, big ideas, long lenses, wide lenses, like... follow that, like you said, fantastic soundtrack. Like the music is awesome. New Charlie XCX sounds great. It's exciting. It's modern. It's sexy. Yeah, Jacob Elordi and Margot Robbie in there doing hard work. Like they both look fantastic. Heathcliff comes out with a freaking earring on, dog. Like it's insane. It looks great. It looks great. I thought Saltburn looked great. I thought Promising Young Woman looked fine. And I feel like just like Saltburn, I'm going to go see Wuthering Heights and I'm going to be into it until the third act when it gets weird and like psychosexual in a way that makes me really uncomfortable. And and that's where it's going to go. But God, it looks great. It's a great looking trailer. Like, I don't know who cut this thing. It looks outstanding. So for what it's worth, I don't know how Wuthering Heights is going to do, but it's coming out Valentine's Day. This is going to be the Valentine's movie, right? Every guy and gal or gal and gal or guy and guy is going to go see Wuthering Heights. I feel like this is going to be the moment, right?
Margot Robbie is incredibly stunning. And it just looks like one of those iconic roles. Like when we first saw like those shots of her as Barbie, I was like, she is Barbie. That's how she looks in here as well. Just like stunning in every dress. Like it looks great, man. It really does. And I'm glad to turn around on something because I don't want to just be a hater.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of people who are like, it's different from the book. They changed Heathcliff. I don't know about any of that. I didn't read the book. But what I do know is like, dude, American audiences will turn out for absolute slop at the cinema. So if you're trying to get people to go see something that's like interesting, you can change it a little bit and they'll go with it. You know what I mean? Like people will go with it. They're not going to know that like, oh my God, it's different than how it used to be. Like, I don't know how it's changed. It could be incredibly damaging to the original work. I don't know. But just... come on, these are the people turning out for like Fantastic Four and Now You See Me 3. We got to talk about the trailer for Wake Up Dead Man. We got a full trailer, which is really exciting. This is the next Rian Johnson whodunit in the Knives Out series, starring Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc. We got Josh O'Connor as a reverend and a whole host of others. Glenn Close, Josh Brolin, Mila Kunis, Jeremy Renner, Kerry Washington, Andrew Scott, Kaylee Spaney. Thomas Hayden Church is in this movie. It is a very exciting feature coming to Netflix and theaters very briefly. I should tell you what's going on in it. Like I said, it's the third Knives Out mystery. Benoit Blanc has to investigate what seems to be a sleepy, foggy New England town when a young reverend is framed or incriminated for the murder of Josh Brolin, his chief pastor or whatever.
Monsignor,
there you go, and has to try to prove that he didn't do it with the help of Benoit Blanc and a host of kooky characters. It's classic whodunit. Looks real great. Really, the reason I want to talk about it here is because it is going to be briefly in limited theater theatrical release, and we'll give those dates here in a second. But if you can, you should probably try to go see it there. That's where we'll see it. Andy, what do you think of the Knives Out trailer? Sorry, what do you think of the Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery trailer?
Man, it looks fun, and I've heard that this is that he's cooking again. That it's maybe better than Glass Onion. And again, it's interesting. We learn in the trailer that Josh O'Connor is kind of the person he's suspect number one. So it's a bit of a two man. Like him and Daniel Craig are trying to solve the mystery together, so he can prove his innocence. Mila Kunis is one of the police officers, which I think is a lot of fun. It's a great cast, and we don't really know what to expect, but we know. It's going to be a whodunit. There's going to be laughs and humor, but there's also usually some social commentary going on underneath. So this looks like a lot of fun. It will be in limited theatrical release starting November 26th, which is, I think, a week from tomorrow. It's next Wednesday. And then it will be everywhere on December 12th on Netflix. So if you want to catch it in theaters, you have like maybe a week to do so starting November 26th.
Yeah, Johnson had mentioned on Twitter, I think just yesterday, that tickets are going to start rolling out this week for limited releases in theaters. So keep an eye on your local haunts, all right, and see if you can get yourself a ticket tonight to the third Knives Out movie. Going to be way better in a theater. Glass Onion was awesome in a theater. I know Netflix barely put it out, but you know, if you can, do. If not, Netflix December 12th will be the movie of the season, the reason for the season. One more. What do you got, Andy? Oh God, I forgot about this one.
We got the kind of teaser for the live-action Moana film, which comes out July 10th this summer. It's going to be a big one. This is only 9 years after the Moana animated film came out, and we're already getting a live-action. There's not really much to say because it's exactly everything from the trailer. It's just live-action. It looks okay. The animation, I mean, that's the thing. A lot of it just looks like animation. It's not like, well, they're clearly not out in the water. They're clearly on a soundstage with wave effects in the background. It looks like a cartoon. It's going to make $1 billion. It'll make $2 billion probably. Moana was a huge hit, and I love Moana. That's a great soundtrack that I blasted all the time in 2016. But it looks fine. I think Disney is running out of ideas because, like, if they're remaking things from less than 10 years ago, they're pretty much done with all the A-plus properties. The problem with doing live action with like your B and C and D properties is like it's a huge risk. Like it could just miss completely and then you've wasted all this money. So who knows where they go from here? But I think this is like kind of the last big one. I mean, maybe they could do Frozen live action, but desperate.
Yeah, Frozen live action seems inevitable. I read that Dwayne Johnson was the big push behind this movie getting made, which could be junk, but I reportedly right around Black Adam, he had started to realize, this may not actually work. I need something to kind of do next year. And remember that like much of the Johnson family is featured in the cast for Moana 2. Like his kids, I think, play a few of the villagers, and like there's kind of like they've got production credit somewhere. Like, just kind of strange, like he was really involved in that, but like it seems like also here he wants to play Maui, right? Like, so it would be an easy live action. Meanwhile, they swapped out Ollie Cravallo for a younger gal for Moana. Also, as far as I know, it is not her singing. I thought it was because you get a bit of the song here in the trailer, but I went and checked it out on IMDb. She has no credits for this movie. She's not appearing in it. She is not singing in the soundtrack. So different person, new young actress. Yeah, like it's surreal to watch because when you get to the animated bits of like the island or the water or the ocean or the cute coconut things, you're like, it just looks like the movie. Like the colors are the same. And like, I think it's made most apparent by who's directing. This is directed by a director named Thomas Kail, actually married to Michelle Williams. Surprising. They have three kids. He has done like very little of note. Very little of note, very little shooting in the volume, very little CGI heavy production. His most notable credit was he was the director of the screen adaptation of Hamilton, which was just the filming of the play that Disney put out in a Fathom event a few years ago. And he did Grease Live, the TV movie, which was, again, kind of an adaptation of a play. He did a couple of episodes of television in 2024 and 2023, and that's it. But you don't need a big director for this, right? Because it's a shot-for-shot remake. We already have a lot of the assets built. The original film came from, I forget the first director, but Ron Clemens, who had previously worked on great Disney hits like Little Mermaid, which is part of the reason this film kind of feels like it's got that similar DNA. And this is just going to be a trotted out within 9 year live-action remake. And it just came right after the second one. Like, it's just a big cash grab. It's very obviously just a cash grab, and it's going to work. It's going to work, and it's going to make a bunch of money. But, you know, I think Disney, dude, just like Call of Duty, why Activision gets a new Call of Duty every single calendar year. There has to be a new iteration of this same property. You burn people out. It does not make for a long time strategy. Like, you do not grow audiences doing this. You know, you're just farming. You're farming the same IP over and over and over again. It's not a good strategy for long-term growth, but they're not worried about that right now because they're going to make $600 million on the new Moana movie.
Yeah, what's real interesting, I didn't know that it wasn't her singing, but I did think, I was like, that sounds exactly like the soundtrack.
It's really close.
And then I'm like, oh, it's not actually her singing. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot that Moana 2 was even a thing. So that's why this feels like so constant. So we've gotten 3 Moana films within 9 years. It just seems like a lot. And yeah, it just looks so bland. And I'm sure it's great for Take the Kids. First big movie of the summer, take your 6-year-old. They won't have seen the first Moana. Probably. But yeah, Disney's running out of ideas. And these were interesting when you were doing like Beauty and the Beast or some of the older properties you've been doing live action, because it was such a jump in technology and animation. But now it's like, Moana's a great movie from not too long ago.
Yeah, people are saying online, this looks like you just ran Moana through a live action AI generator, right? Like make a live action version of Moana and this is what it would look like. And they're right. And like effectively that's what they're doing. Like the talent they have making this thing don't have experience doing it. They're just following directions. Just execute in this order. Put these scenes together and make them look like this and then hand it over to VFX and they will make it look as close as you can. And it's like, I don't know. I'm sure it's going to make a ton of money, but in my heart, I wish it didn't. I wish it was a big fat bomb and Disney would go, huh, this was stupid. We shouldn't try to shill this kind of crap on people, but here we are.
Yeah.
I know. There's not.
I don't really have much. I don't have much more to say on that.
I got to take off my mouse ears and get back in the show. Yeah, I can't keep getting mad at Disney. One more film to talk about this week on the podcast. Really excited to talk about this one. Like I said at the top, like I feel like people have been saying this might be a misstep for Oz Perkins, but I'm excited to get into it. Andy's gonna be taking the summary. Andy, please take it away.
Keeper. Like Zach said, this is the latest film from Osgood Perkins, who previously did The Monkey and, of course, Long Legs, which was a huge hit last summer. And this man is working. This is his third film in like 18 months, and he's already got his next thing upcoming up with Nicole Kidman. So he stays grinding. Like I said, it had interesting production history where they had to pause production on The Monkey because of the labor strikes. They kind of got around it with this film, with hiring kind of a more amateur writer and also working in Canada, Canadian production outside of the guild or whatever. So that was produced in the middle of The Monkey and then it's coming out after. So interesting things. It stars Tatiana Maslany as Liz and Rosef Sutherland, son of Kiefer Sutherland, as Malcolm. They are a couple in love. They're going away to his cabin for the weekend to spend a nice romantic time. Cabin is beautiful. It's secluded. There is one next to it that where his cousin lives. He said, but he's gone. Well, we're not going to see him at all. And things are kind of weird at the place. Like I said, very secluded, big cabin. And it's just these two, they're kind of rattling around in a kind of Shining-esque way. We do, of course, the cousin does show up with his own model girlfriend who doesn't speak any English, and he's just this brash, annoying kind of guy. Like they're both very, they come from a lot of wealth. Just get bad vibes. And then there's this cake that was left by the caretaker who Malcolm doesn't seem, he's like, oh yeah, she always leaves us here, we tell her not to, doesn't, you know, we'll have it later, it's fine, it's not too bad. This cake is kind of sinister. Like we know from the beginning, like something's not quite right. And something's not quite right at this cabin. And we don't really know what's going on. There seems to be some sort of presence there in the woods, possibly. And then this is also juxtaposed with the very beginning of the film that shows this sequence of relationships from start to finish with no sound. It's just a montage of like meeting, flirting, marriage, and then a kind of a gruesome end. And we see this happen over generations, different time periods where women kind of go through this same progression. And we're back here. And, you know, is Tatiana Maslany's character, is she next in line? Who knows? A lot going on, lots to say. Zach, what do you think?
So I was a little skeptical going into this one, like I think a lot of people are, because Oz Perkins has a funny reputation in horror right now. Long Legs was kind of his big breakout following Black Coat's Daughter, which is a lot smaller. We've covered all these on the show, by the way. You covered Black Coat's Daughter. We covered Long Legs and The Monkey when they came out. But Long Legs was kind of the big one. A lot of people saw the viral marketing. They got really excited. A lot of people went and saw it and thought, miss, doesn't work. Not it. But Andy and I were into it. We like Long Legs. Then we saw The Monkey, right? A lot of people saw it, a little bigger in scope, kind of based on something nostalgic people are already familiar with. A King adaptation, right? Another Stephen King adaptation. And people thought, yeah, that looks cool. And then they went and saw it and thought, miss, doesn't work, not into it. But Andy and I saw it and mostly liked The Monkey. Like a little different, but for the most part, into it. And then this one came about and actually seemed to step back from all of that. It said, hey, smaller budget, way smaller cast. This is a dark trip from Osgood Perkins, like similar kind of viral marketing, but kind of scoped to be smaller. And then it comes out and people say it's a rare miss from Osgood Perkins. A rare miss, which is weird because it seemed like a lot of people didn't think he was having a lot of hits anyway. But going into it, like that's a weird way to walk into a movie to think, hey, this is kind of not as good as the others, but also it's smaller, so maybe it's something different. You know, you want to be open-minded. And like from an open-minded standpoint, like I think Keeper's not bad. Like, I don't think Keeper is a bad movie, but similar to Running Man, I think it's less than the sum of its parts. Like there are sequences in Keeper that are a lot of fun and creepy. And like, we got a great setting. This cabin is odd. We have two kind of smaller, lesser known actors, especially Sutherland. I've never seen him in anything. People have said his performance kind of doesn't work in this. I came around on him mostly by the, at first for sure. I was like, who is this guy? He's not a very good actor. It's all right. I think he gets there. But I think Miss Lonnie has a lot of work to do in this movie. And I think she does a great job, but ultimately like, I think the core mystery is not that juicy. When you actually kind of get down to what's going on, you're like, oh, and I think that's what hurts it. I think people leave the theater and they're like, oh, this felt like a lesser this movie, or this felt like a lesser version of that. And like, I never claimed to be anything big. It's quite humble. And in that way, I think it's good, but it's not great. I don't think it's as good as Monkey. I don't think it's as good as Long Legs. What'd you think?
So I couldn't figure out what kind of horror movie we were watching for a long stretch of it. I was like, okay, is this like a home invasion film? Like, is someone going to break in? Is the cousin a serial killer? Is the house haunted? Are the woods outside haunted?
Yeah.
Is she haunted? Is he haunted? Is she a killer? Like, I didn't know what kind of movie it was gonna be. I think it does get going. Like, I think it gets better the longer it goes. Third act is, I think, really strong.
Yeah.
But man, the first thing I said to Zach after the movie, I was like, Keeper, more like Sleeper, because it is so slow in the first half. I was like,
yeah,
where are we going? It just take, again, it's a little bit of a relationship drama as well, because they've been dating for about a year. They're talking about, like, you know, are they going to get serious, or is this whole thing like he's bought one of her paintings to put in the cabin, but it feels very just kind of condescending at the same time. But it just, and again, it starts to get some creeps here and there, but it just takes a while to get to that, like the good stuff. I think when the stuff gets good, it gets real good, but man, that first two-thirds of it, I was struggling.
Yeah, like he's very good at shooting wide and letting your eyes linger in the back of the frame, right? Like, and that's something that happens a lot here, especially on the ceiling. You start to notice very quickly that characters keep kind of looking up, and you keep kind of getting these shots of like you looking up at them, and then behind them just like these kind of tall, big slanted ceilings and this very like kind of art deco-y cabin. Miss Lonnie's character describes at one point to a friend, she calls on the phone, she's like, yeah, there's no locks on the doors and it's all windows. So it just feels like I'm very kind of like I'm not safe. I'm kind of exposed here, you know. And at one point when Malcolm has to leave to go take care of some work in the city, she's kind of left alone out there. And this is where things kind of start to escalate in Act Two and get going. But you're right. Like, you can't decide, is this dream sequence stuff? Like, is she actually seeing these things? The movie like kind of establishes his language real early when she's taking a bath, and they do this kind of like superimpose effect of like water running around her head and like her starting to hear these things. Like, you start to see some things very quickly that break out of like the normal cinematic language of grounded reality and start to be odd and strange, and visions start to turn into madness. And I think all that stuff works okay, but yeah, I think people, like, once you figure out where it's going, you're not as impressed as it in the rear view. Like, I was into a lot of like the lingering shots of like shadows on the walls, you know, and like what's going on here, and kind of you hear something in the background. But also, like, small cast, you know, small budget. Like, so you're getting a humble answer. And I think people are disappointed by that, like, that they come out at the end of it and be like, that's it. That's what was going on. It's a shame. Like, in a vacuum, in a bubble, if you'd never seen any other horror movies, solid. But you got to compare it to a lot of genre bests. And I think that makes this feel small. I think this makes this feel a little bit more insignificant. And finding out they worked on it during the strike, I mean, that's no fun. Boo. I don't like that at all.
Yeah, not great. Yeah, it. Like I said, there's this historical stuff that opens the film of these, like, you know, a relationship in, like, the colonial times, and then, like, the 30s, the 50s, this kind of thing. And it doesn't really tie that into the film until pretty late. And I feel like we needed some more breadcrumbs along the way, because for lots of it, I'm just like, what is going on? Is she hallucinating? Is this real? Is it a dream? It's a bit of a mix. And I just think we needed a little bit. You got to give the audience a little bit more along the way, because I do think the payoff is real strong. Like a lot of horror movies, like by the time you get to act three, things get crazy, but man, it's just a long time there.
I think it's my favorite Maslany performance. I was reading people say that she does isn't that good in this movie, and I feel the opposite. I'm like, I liked her in this way more than She-Hulk, and she's in The Monkey a bit as his mom character, but like really just kind of in act one, and she's kind of doing something funny there anyway. Her character is very, very cynical and has this really, I don't know, but like she's really grounded in this. I think she's really good. I'd like to see her in more stuff. Like I said, Sutherland's all right. Like, he's all right. He gets there by the end, but I get why I haven't seen him in a lot of features. Do we know, like, the next thing Osgood Perkins is doing is bigger. I think we had a story last week that we ended up nixing from the outline that was Nicole Kidman's going to be in his next horror feature. So we know he's kind of getting back on the horse with stuff, and this was just kind of something small in the meantime. I guess I got to know, Andy, would you recommend Keeper?
I would recommend this to, if you're a big Osgood Perkins fan like myself, or if you're a big horror fan and looking for something interesting, I would still say probably save it for streaming. If you're not a fan of either of those two, I would say probably it's a pass. But for the horror heads among us, I'd say it's worth seeing, but it's not like a must-see in theaters.
Yeah, kind of the same. If you're a horror head, go for it. If you're looking for just something to watch around, you know, spook season, like, gonna skip it. Like, it'll come to streamers, I'm guessing HBO, but I don't actually know for sure. It'll be on the front page. You'll be like, oh hey, Keeper. And also, like, great runtime, by the way. Does not overstay its welcome. Feels a little long somehow, but I think it's just because there's not many people in it. It ends up being a bit more of an isolation kind of story through a large part of it, but, like, you know, fine for streaming. No reason to go rush out to the theaters and see it. That's Keeper.
The Young People is the name of his next film with Nicole Kidman.
All right. The Young
People. With Neon.
Curious to see what that looks like. Yeah, dude, I feel like my man's never beaten the hater allegations. Like, a lot of people have said, like, since Long Legs, he's not that good. And I don't think this is a miss, per se. Like, I don't think this is another step towards him being bad, but, like, it doesn't help his case. It's kind of like Wright and The Running Man a little bit. It's like, not exactly the new banger. Yeah, not exactly a masterpiece. And that's okay, but, like, tough to recommend. That's all. So that's Keeper. Man, if you're curious, if you want to see what's going on in this thing, go for it. I don't think we gave too much away, but that's episode 315 of the podcast. Andy, what are we watching next week?
Wicked for Good is coming out this week. It's the big Wicked week. That's going to be a huge billion-dollar movie. Or something. It's going to be a huge weekend for that. That comes out this Friday, November 21st. Also taking a look at Train Dreams, which is a big, it's an Oscar film that's coming out on Netflix on Friday as well, starring Joel Edgerton. I don't really know much about it other than I've heard, like, it's making people's top 10 lists. It got rave reviews out of the festivals. People are bawling through it. Nothing but good things. It's supposed to be this incredible emotional movie, like I said, on Netflix this Friday, November 21st. An FYI release, Rental Family, the not Brendan Gleeson, Brendan Fraser film where he's an actor that he goes to Japan and gets hired to play people's fathers and parents. That kind of dramedy is coming out this Friday as well. Surprising. That movie's, I think, getting kind of brushed under the rug. But Wicked for Good and Train Dreams next week.
Are you as rattled by the very early Wicked for Good reviews as I am? Because I kind of just assumed it would be a banger, and it seems like reviews are coming out. People are like, uh-oh. doesn't stick the landing as good as the first one did. I think it's supposedly that's how the play goes, though. I think the second half is not as good as the first half. That's what I've heard. What do you think?
That's what I've heard. It's a little weak, but I don't think it's going to matter. I think it's still going to make a ton of money. But the other thing is, I was discussing this with someone else, that's a bit how Broadway stuff is, because they just got to get you in the door.
Yeah, man.
Once you buy the ticket, like, the second half can be lame, because like I said, you've gotten through the first half and you've stayed after the intermission. So I'm sure it's going to make a lot of money, but I have heard that it is weak. But they've also apparently woven elements of the book, which is different from the stage play as well. It's very different. They're like, I started reading the book and I was like, oh my god, this is like really violent and lots of sex. I was like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. So that was a big shock. So I'm interested to see how this goes. It's gonna be huge. That's all we know.
If you enjoyed the podcast, if you like what we're doing here on Off-Script Film Review, best way to support us is just subscribe to the show on YouTube or Instagram or Facebook. Just follow us somewhere. Just engage, right? Click like or share or hit the notification bell. Hell, even leaving a comment is super helpful. All that stuff drives the algo, right? The almighty algorithm in the sky that drives us up, puts us in front of more people. So if you like what we're doing here, leave a comment. Tell us you liked it, right? Shoot us a DM. Hit us at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com or email. You can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com, where we post full reviews, more content, press stuff. Our YouTube channel has a lot going on. Check us out over there at Offscript Film Review. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all these social media places. If you want to take us in your ears on the go, you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia, Off-Script Ears Edition, as it were. And keep here next week for Wicked and Train Dreams, which I also don't know a lot about. So I'm going to try to go in dry on Train Dreams. Supposed to be a big, well, humble awards contender. We'll see. But from all of us at Off-Script, the home of bold cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.